to remind you that if you have not yet registered, please pick up one of the brochures and fill out the registration form and get that registration information to Sean Lucas, who is, most of you know him, but he's standing in the back there. Please take care of that so we can have a good record of our conference attendance. Now, if we're exploring Southern Baptist identity at this conference, and this begs the question of what is Southern, and why Dr. Muller was asked last night about the name Southern Baptist, and he said, it will never change. But the student who asked that question, being from the North, obviously had some, felt that this having the adjective Southern there implies something, means something. So I'd like for our panel to discuss a bit. What does it mean to be Southern Baptist? And I'd like for each of our panelists to give a brief, a very brief explanation of what, in your estimation, does it mean to be Southern? What is the South? And one way we may want to go about that is to address Adrian Rogers' quote, Memphis is more Southern than South Florida. That might be one way to get at it. But if we could just go down the line and briefly, what is the South? Paul, why don't you get us started?
Thanks for starting at that end of the table.
Well, actually, I do like Paul's suggestion.
My answer was going to be the South, yes, whatever the South. John Shelton Reed says.
It's an awesome.
He hasn't had a chance to talk yet.
Second.
That's right.
Move the question.
John Reed tonight is going to address at great length what is the South and how is the South changing. But I do like the idea to let him lead off here just in a very briefly. What is the South?
I'm not sure I can answer that very briefly, and I'm going to try to answer it at some length tonight. In fact, the title of my talk tonight is What's Southern About the South These Days? And but you know, the question that's stated here is, are Southern Baptists Southern anymore, and does it matter? You know, it's up to you all to say whether it matters. It's not for an Episcopalian like me, but you know, plainly, I was distressed, though not surprised, to hear Dr. Muller say last night that there's been discussion of changing the name of your denomination. You know, if I'd been a little quicker witted, I'd have said, well, you know, the Roman Catholic Church has done all right, even though it's not particularly Roman. There's a process at work here where when something Southern gets attractive and goes national, it stops being Southern. You know, and it happened to the Waltons, if you remember them on television. They started out as Virginians, and they had these Virginia accents, but 2 years later, they'd lost their accents. I don't know if anybody noticed that besides Jack Kirby, and they're just this wholesome farm family who just happened to be somewhere, you know, in TV land. When Bojangles opened a restaurant in Times Square, the New Yorker magazine had a story about it, quoted the manager who said, this is not Southern food, it's just American food from some other part of the country. You know, apparently there's something about being Southern that's a market liability. I think the Southern Baptist Convention, you know, in the fullness of time, may be like the North Carolina National Bank, which became First Nations Bank, is now Bank America, you know. You all could become Church America, but actually I know your ambitions are broader than that. You might wind up like Coca-Cola, you know, which is now teaching the world to sing. It's not a Georgia soft drink anymore, but for the time being, it seems to me, Southern Baptist Convention is more like country music or NASCAR. You know, it's something that's still rooted in its region of origin, still reflects the South in its ethos, even though it's now got a much broader appeal. And I think for some time to come, it's going to be flavored by the South. Certainly for some time to come, it's going to flavor the South, and that's one thing I want to talk about tonight. You know, the South may be becoming less important for the Southern Baptist Convention, but the Southern Baptist Convention is still terribly important for the South. You want to understand the South, you've got to understand at least something about its dominant religion, its state church, which you all are, like it or not. I think there are some resonances here, and W.J. Cash was mentioned earlier today. Cash, 1940 in the Mind of the South, wrote about Southern culture and what he saw as its eternal and unchanging nature. I think he was wrong about some important things. In particular, he was wrong. He would never have guessed the changes in race relations that have taken place in the last 60 years. But I think he was on the money about another Southern trait, and it's one that characterizes your theological tradition as well, and that's individualism and individual responsibility. You know, I think this sense that you've got to walk the Lonesome Valley by yourself, that their institutions are there to help you, but they're not intermediaries. They don't mediate for you, that it's up to you eventually, in the last analysis, to make that decision, to choose. Is reflected not just in Southern religious life, but in Southern politics and Southern culture more generally. I could elaborate on this. I have actually a bit in writing, but I think I've talked long enough. You guys have had time to think now. Say something intelligent.
Barry, why don't you go next?
Well, I'll just start with I'm into disclaimers today. I'm not actually a Southern historian per se. I'm really someone who studies evangelicalism and fundamentalism, and I just happen to have gotten interested in Southern subjects really because of, as I said, being from Michigan, going to Baylor, and just proximity, kind of had this advantage of being an outsider who was living on the inside of something and could see it in a different way than maybe insiders would, or outsiders who never got to be on the inside of it. So. So, you know, I just, most of the time when I talk about this, it's more, you know, personal and anecdotal than anything I could buttress with scholarly sort of statements or research. Paul would, you know, much better at that than I would be, and certainly John Shelton Reed. But just as some experiences that strike me as interesting, when I, as a 19-year-old, moved from Michigan to Texas, and stayed there for 3 years, and then left, and then went back to Texas again. I've lived in Waco 4 times, and I, you know, about the second, well, probably the first, second times I lived there, third time, I thought I was living in the South. Being from Michigan, I was living in Central Texas, and I thought I was living in the South. And I'd lived there long enough. I began to think of myself as, you know, like so many transplanted Yankees. I mean, like, this is my home now, I'll never be a true Texan. They wouldn't let me be that because I wasn't born there. But you know, at least this is where I am, and this is part of who I am. But then in 1990, I left Waco and moved to Central Louisiana to take a position at Louisiana College. And when we were getting ready to move, all my friends in Waco said, "Oh, you're not going to believe how different Louisiana is going to be." And I thought this was just Texocentrism, you know, that they were telling me, you know, looking down on Louisiana because it wasn't Texas, and it really was different. When I moved to Louisiana, I realized I had not been living in the South all those years. I had been living in the Southwest, and the flavor of life was quite different. But again, I have to qualify that because Waco is a city of about 100,000, and I moved to two cities on either side of a river. The larger one was about 50,000. So then I had to ask, well, are the differences I'm seeing here because of the size of the city and because Waco has a major university, and now I'm at a small college, or are they really regional differences? And I think there's probably some of both, but I really never felt like Waco was the South anymore. I felt like it was the Southwest, and I tell people that when I would drive from Louisiana back to Waco to visit friends and do research, somewhere in the Piney Woods of East Texas, I would cross some line somewhere, and I was no longer in the South, I was then in the Southwest. This is my own perception of it. Well, that went along real well until Diana Garland, who used to be the dean of the social work school here at Southern Seminary, came down to Baylor, and I got to be friends with her. And having lived in Louisville for many, many years and then moving to Waco, she now was telling me Waco was in the South. And the reason she said it was in the South is that she said that in Louisville she never took a walk around her neighborhood and saw a Confederate flag on the wall of a living room, and that happened in the neighborhood where she lived. So I began to think, okay, well, maybe that's true. But then I thought, wait a minute, Diana lives out in the suburbs, and I live in the city. So, of course, out in the white suburbs, the white flight suburbs, of course, you're going to get some of that Southern Confederate flag sort of stuff, but not here in town, you know, where I live. So I don't know. It's very, very complicated, and I guess it depends on one's perspective. And then just one other thing I'll mention is that I sometimes run into, you know, colleagues at various universities who are arguing, not so much in a scholarly way, but more anecdotally like I'm doing here, that the South isn't distinctive anymore. And I really want to, and if these are colleagues from the North, you know, I want to ask them, have you ever lived in the South? But then I've had some who moved from the North to the South and have claimed it wasn't that different. Then I got to thinking, if they move from a major university town in the North to a major university town in the South, well, you know, to refer to my paper, they went from working with a bunch of Rawlsian liberals in the North to a bunch of Rawlsian liberals in the South, so there probably wasn't that much difference. So, you know, I think it depends on a lot on the size of the location. Is it urban? Is it rural? Is it near a university? I think all those things seem to play into it, just from my own experiences. And so that's where I'm at right now.
Well, I haven't lived in the South since 1982, except for 1 year tormenting Bill Sumner in Nashville many years ago, 1988. And other than that, I've lived in California, Indiana, and Colorado. So I know the South more by perception than by the reality of whatever it is or isn't. Now, I'm living in Charlottesville right now, but just for 3 months. That's a whole different thing. It's Dave Matthews' land, I think. But I did an article a while back, several years ago, lighthearted piece, about the perception of the South, which is what I know most about because people are always, in Berkeley, people are always asking me about it constantly. And despite the fact that I'm from Western Oklahoma, which is basically Wizard of Oz, first 15 minutes, Tornado Alley kind of land, not very Southern at all, they perceive the South as a land where conservatism still reigned. Of course, being from Berkeley, they weren't very happy about that, but that was certainly their perception, and where there were certain kinds of manners which were attractive in the one sense, but ultimately they were uncomfortable with what they perceived as a kind of conservatism of social manner, of politics, of behavior, and so forth and so on. And when I began to investigate contemporary expressions of the South, musical expressions, stock car racing, all kinds of other things. It's, in fact, precisely the opposite of that. The South is not about community. The South is about individuality, as John Shelton Reed just said. And so I'm not able to say what the South is because it seems to be betwixt and between that kind of all sorts of perceptions and then the fact that the reality is that the South expresses certain kinds of mainstream values, such as American individualism, despite the fact that it is seen as the land where that doesn't take place because communal values take precedence. And maybe there's some way in which that connects to President Mueller's comments about the Truth Party and the Liberty Party from last night, and there may be some way to connect that to a broader kind of argument about Southern identity, about communal values versus individual freedom. And of course, that plays into the issues of Baptist identity. How do you interpret E.Y. Mullins? Is it about soul competence, or is it about certain confessional doctrines? Short answer, I don't know.
David, you can solve the riddle here.
Okay. Well, I'll give my disclaimer. I'm a known Presbyterian. But I am a Southern historian, so there. That's not a Baptist historian, although I've written about Southern Baptist history. I think that one of the things we've already touched on in this panel is that there are many Souths. There probably are more similarities among them than they have in common with other regions. The very notion of regionalism. I mean, what other? If you live in New England, you're a New Englander. If you live in the Pacific Northwest, you know where that is. If you live in the Great Plains, you know where that is. Generally, the other regions are pretty diffuse, hard to put your finger on. Something John mentioned, I think, has been described as both the Americanization of Dixie and the Southernization of the United States. That's a two-way street. We may have some time to talk about that. Certainly, as the Solid South has come to change in meaning, Southerners have become more prominent politically in the last generation. So that's been a big change. I think, though, to get back to the question, that I'll take a stab at what the South is. I think that this is not to say that this is unique to the South, because I have millions of examples of exceptions, but I think Southerners do indeed have a strong sense of place. I still think that's important. Now, having said that, I will quote various people, various cultural geographers who say, the South is wherever you think the South is. If you're a Southerner in Detroit working in the auto industry, or somebody from the upper South who went into Cincinnati to get a job, you take the South with you. And there are lots of country music lovers in those places, lots of NASCAR lovers, and lots of other examples of the South in places that aren't technically Southern. Indeed, lots of Southern Baptists. Which brings me to kind of back to the thing, I may be getting ahead of Greg's outline, but one of the things that I discovered in my interviews is that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I've been told this, and I was poking around in the Heritage Room earlier this morning and saw some of the Lottie Moon materials and things, and this, and I love the fireplace. If you haven't been down there, go look at it, with the stones from the various Southern states, including Illinois, interestingly. It says stones from Southern states and D.C. And there they are, plus Illinois and Missouri. They're honorary Southern states. But also foreign countries, not all the ones where Southern Baptists had missionaries, but a good representation. And some very interesting things. But the Southern Baptists, I'm told, were most prominent in Northern China. And the Northern Baptists were most prominent in Southern China, which is very confusing to the Chinese, being evangelized by Baptist missionaries from the United States. We're in the South. We know we're in the South. We've seen a map. Why are we supposed to be Northern Baptists and vice versa? This is very confusing to people. But the Northern and Southern Baptists did that without fear of any confusion at all in their own minds. But I think that we have superimposed on the world this kind of cultural map that doesn't, in fact, make much sense to other people. I'm like John. I think that it would be a great tragedy if only that the world will stop making sense if we stop talking about Southern Baptists. And so maybe for that reason alone, that there is still a South.
I would say too that the tribal ethos that was being spoken of last night, although it may conflict with the theological ethos, it certainly exists if you show up. I travel a lot in various research trips, and I go to various churches of all different stripes, Buddhist, Baptist, whatever, just to be an observer mainly. And the tribal ethos, regardless of whether it's a moderate church, conservative church, it's really there, certainly there in California, where a good deal of my mother's family lives, which are among the most Southern churches I've ever been to in terms of ethos, in terms of just feeling.
We are looking very much forward to John's paper tonight, as we are getting. We sense that there is this Southern identity. We know it. It's you come to the South and it's the air you breathe. I lived in the Boston area for 4 years, and at the end of those 4 years, I was convinced that I was a Yankee. It was such a good experience for me in so many ways. I loved so much of what I found there in New England, the history. I even liked the gruffness and the aggressive driving in many ways. But when I came back South, I realized that my identity was not Northern, it was Southern. And I would read certain documents, I would hear certain songs, and it would catch me by surprise that I still have a Southern identity. But it's very difficult to define, isn't it? But let me ask you, what did Adrian Rogers mean when he said Memphis is more Southern than South Florida was? And Barry, this was a significant statement. Why don't you start off? What did he mean by that?
Well, I think what he meant was that when he was in South Florida in the early 70s at Merritt Island, which I guess is close to NASA headquarters, there were people from all over the country moving into that area and attending his church. And so his church had this, and again, I'm just kind of interpreting his statement here. He didn't elaborate that much, but I think what he was getting at is his church had a kind of a diversity about it, it didn't have a sort of Southern accent, a sort of Southern identity that even someplace in the upper South like Memphis would have even 25 years later. And so people brought their experiences from New York and and New England and all over the country in with them. So I think that's what he was getting at. I think there's something to that. Sam Hill uses a term, I don't know if he's ever actually used this in writing or if he just used it in conversation, but Samuel S. Hill, one of the noted historians of Southern culture of our generation, he has a term I like. He calls it cultural ethnicity. And he says that the South has a cultural ethnicity about it. And in terms of Southern Baptists, he told me once he thinks it's almost impossible to ever be fully Southern Baptist if you didn't grow up Southern Baptist. And that's probably becoming less the case now than it used to be. But that resonated with me because, again, being from Michigan and coming into a Southern Baptist context as a student at Baylor and then joining moderate Southern Baptist churches, there was always this sort of conversation going on that I didn't know what they were talking about. You know, there was always a sort of assumed knowledge that I didn't have, and I really had this sense. Now, that's obviously changing both as more diverse people come into the South and as Southern Baptist churches spring up all over the country, but historically, I think it's been that way.
Let me add to that it's very difficult, or at least it used to be difficult, to grow up in the South, whatever your denomination, and not be part Southern Baptist. I mean, I went to college in Massachusetts, and my best friend was from Arkansas. I was an Episcopalian. He was a Christian Scientist. But one of the reasons we liked each other was that not only we have a similar sense of humor, but we all knew the same Baptist hymns, because we used to sing them in school, I don't know that they do that anymore. But the question about Memphis and South Florida, I'm going to talk tonight about several different versions of the South defined by different combinations of things. But, whichever version of the South you're talking about, Memphis is part of it. Dixie, the land of cotton, it's Southern Baptist and country music and NASCAR, Ted Turner and CNN, it's that too. But whatever you're talking about, South Florida is not it. South Florida is really off. A journalist named Joel Garreau wrote a book a few years back called The Nine Nations of North America, where he divided up not just the United States, but the entire continent into nine regions that he called nations. And he put South Florida in a nation with the Caribbean. He said it's basically the capital of the Caribbean. It's where everybody does their banking. Where they all have the homes that they go to in a revolution, wherever they are, and it's got an economy that's based on tourism and drugs, retirement. And ethnically, it's different. Economically, it's different. Ecologically, it's different. Whatever you mean by the South, Miami's not in it, except there's no other place to put it if you're carving up the United States. On this business of cultural ethnicity, I'm not a historian, I'm a sociologist, and I and some other folks over the years have gotten a lot of mileage out of taking that analogy, which is what it is, quite literally, and ask the same questions about Southerners that people ask about Italian Americans or Jewish Americans or African Americans, questions about group identity and stereotyping and cultural boundary maintenance and all of this, intermarriage, all the rest of it. In some ways it's a pretty good analogy. In a few ways it's not, but that's interesting. That's interesting too. I think for the most part you can treat Southerners as like an ethnic group. All of the mechanisms that you see at work in Chicago, different ethnic groups interact with one another, you can see operating at the level of regional groups. One of the interesting things about it, though, is that in recent years, I think the nature of group identity has changed. If you used that word Southerner in 1900, you didn't need a racial qualification. It meant white Southerner. About the only black American who's referred to himself as a Southerner, so far as I know, around 1900 was Booker T. Washington, a significant exception. It's on his tombstone. Basically, you said Southerner, you meant white. That's not true anymore, and it hasn't been true since about 1976. We actually have some survey data to show that black American, black Southerners, Southern blacks began to think of themselves as Southerners in significant numbers between 1964 and 1976. Now think about what was happening during those years. Among other things, they were laying claim to that identity, and now black Southern politicians, at least ones who are being elected with significant white minority support, again and again refer to themselves as Southerners. Andrew Young does it, Doug Wilder did it, Harvey Gantt did it, we Southerners. That's an interesting change, and I find it a very heartening one.
I think that you can pick up right there and say, I think it's interesting that you don't really say that until there are lots of African Americans who go north. As race relations became more of a national phenomenon, I think about, I'm going to quote Bob Dylan tonight in another context, but his song Highway 61 Revisited. Highway 61 is a part of a magnetic pull, pulling Southern blacks, particularly up to Chicago in the first half of the 20th century. Some of which that migration has been reversed largely, as John was saying, formerly Southern blacks or people of that descent reclaiming the South. But another religious historian, Paul Simon, erred in his theological treatise, Graceland, when he referred to Mississippi Delta as the cradle of the Civil War. It's not the cradle of the Civil War. but it was certainly this magnet. And I think that he, by focusing on Memphis and by focusing on the that region, he does indeed, I think, do a good thing in talking about what James Cobb refers to as the most southern place on earth in his book about the Delta. But once southern blacks start going north, then northerners become aware of the South in a very different way, and particularly the fact that racial segregation, Jim Crow, got nationalized to a great extent. And don't ever forget that the Brown decision, there were five decisions bundled by the court in 1954, but the first one didn't come from Meridian, Mississippi, came from Topeka, Kansas. So the nationalization of race relations was a prominent part of this phenomenon.
Just by way of anecdote on this issue of cultural ethnicity, there are all sorts of little phrases and, you know, bumper sticker sort of things that just don't exist outside the South. Like one, you know, American by birth, Southerner by the grace of God. You know, I never heard anybody say American by birth, Northerner by the grace of God. You know?
Midwesterner.
Yeah, and if you're from Michigan, I guess you're a Michigander, but we don't. It's not a big deal. You know, of course, Texas is off the map on this, but, you know, Texas Texan. You know, yeah. I always think, you know, I was kidding my native Texas friends, you know, that when they meet people in Europe, people ask them where they're from. They probably say Texas. I'm a Texan. You know? Where is that? Oh, it's in America. You know?
Bear, though, I was in Houston last summer, and I saw a bumper sticker that I've not seen in North Carolina. It said, "Welcome to the South. Now leave your daughter and go home."
It's just so this sense of region being like an ethnic sense. It just it never existed for me. Again, this is not something I've studied, but just as in learning, it never existed for me. A regional identity. I mean, I'm Midwest, but it's just not a big deal. You know, being a Midwesterner doesn't loom large in one's consciousness, at least in my experience of growing up in the upper Midwest.
So are Southern Baptists Southern? Paul, what do you think?
Southern Baptists are part of the Southern ethnicity, if we're going to use that term, and as far as I can tell, what I've seen, they have the kind of unspoken ethos and unspoken language that is puzzling sometimes to outsiders. So in that sense, rather ill-defined sense, yes. The question I'm interested in addressing now, which I know absolutely nothing about, is as I understand it, blacks are among one of the more quickly growing groups of churches in the SBC. Is that correct?
Yes.
And whether they, how they feel about the tag Southern, whether they identify with Southerners, and whether they, how that would affect the kind of Southern identity of the Southern Baptist Convention. That's just a question that I know absolutely nothing about, but seems to me to be a very pertinent question to raise.
Yeah.
It's obviously a yes and no question, and here's where I would say it's a. With Paul, I would agree that if you take President Mueller's categories from last night, which are helpful, not exhaustive, where you have a tribal and a confessional identity, and tribally, I would say the Southern Baptist conservative leadership, is Southern and Southern Baptist tribally, but they, I think, intentionally want to move from a tribal identity and have succeeded to a large extent in moving from a tribal identity to a more confessional identity. And as you move from a tribal identity to a more confessional identity, I would argue you're becoming less Southern and more like the rest of the evangelical world. Not so much necessarily, just lay aside the question of whether you're becoming more like the rest of the American culture, but in terms of a theological sort of subculture, I think you see Southern Baptist conservatives becoming less tribally Southern Baptist and more confessionally evangelical. And my guess is, as this continues to happen, and we were talking about this with Professor Wills, you'll see more and more people from other regions who are converted and join Southern Baptist churches and come to places like Southern to be educated, and they'll feel more and, let's say, maybe less and less kind of out of the loop as a place like this becomes more evangelical and a little less Southern Baptist. But it's always going to have, I think it's for a long time, for the foreseeable future, it's going to have both. So if you see, I would see it this way then, from tribal toward confessional, from SBC toward evangelical, as long as you keep in mind that there's elements of both that are always at work.
But this is not a rhetorical question, isn't the flip side of that coin that you have people dropping off who previously were in it because it was tribal, they were sort of cultural Baptists, but when it becomes confessional and they don't fit, then they'll look around for some place that either doesn't care what they believe or believes what they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, my movement here is just confined to the conservatives, I think, who want to identify with that larger evangelical world, but a lot of moderates perhaps are uncomfortable with that confessionalism, and in fact their identity was tribal, and so they don't have an identity in Southern Baptist life anymore.
I'm not even thinking of moderates and conservatives. I'm thinking about folks who are sufficiently untheological that, just ordinary people who grew up Baptist and haven't seen any reason to change may not think about it much. There may not be such people, but I'm an Episcopalian. I know lots of them in my community.
Yeah, I'm not sure they care much about the theological fights. Their identity is grounded so much in this ethnicity, this Southern Baptist ethnicity. I don't know. Go ahead.
Week before last, I spoke on Southern Baptist Conservatives Church-State Views to a moderate crowd, the Texas Christian Life Commission. And I don't know why I would subject myself in this way to Southern Baptists twice in the same month, but I really expected to get lambasted at this meeting because I'm basically taking Southern Baptist Conservatives' ideas seriously and trying to say that they're coherent in large respect. But the response was very good, and several people came up and said that's what we needed to hear because they've been on the other side of all these fights. And one in particular, literally a little old lady came up to me with tears in her eyes, and she said, I'm one of those who's been so hurt by all of this, and I've been so bitter, and I just needed to hear that. And what I think she was saying was something like, these people, these conservatives, had kind of upset her tribal identity, and she needed to hear that they were people too, and they had ideas and they had concerns, and they hadn't intentionally done anything to her. I don't know. Maybe I'm reading more into it than I could, but what makes me think of this is this. I think David could probably attest to this too. We used to be in the same church together, and I've been in churches that long. It took them a long time after they realized they had nothing, very little in common with the Southern Baptist conservatives who now control the denomination. It took them a long time to sever their ties. And I think the reason was the tribal identity was so strong amongst especially the, 50, 60, 70-year-old people who've been Southern Baptists all of their lives. So it's a wrenching transition, I think, to move from a tribal identity to a confessional identity. And I think that wrenching transition may have been borne out on this campus more than anywhere else in the mid-1990s.
And Barry, I think you see it going the other way also, as the controversy has gone to the states, and the fight has usually been over the state college. And so in Georgia, where you have a convention that has been controlled by conservatives in the state for many years, they appointed the president there, R. Kirby Godsey, published a book in which he made universalist statements, statements denying the Trinity and the deity of Christ, these kinds of things. And the conservatives, being in control, appointed two study committees, one to study his doctrine, another to study the relationship to the university. And they came back and reported that Kirby Godsey was indeed a heretic, but that they would continue to support the university. But I think what that shows is that the conservatives, too, have this tribal identity, and in some ways it trumps, at times, their professed confessional convictions. So they're not about to sever ties to the university, because that university represents for them what it means to be a Georgia Baptist and a Southern Baptist.
I was struck last night listening to President Moeller, and I'm struck again today by the sort of implicit evolutionary model here that somehow tribal identity is primitive and a confessional one is modern, and there's an inexorable trend from one to the other. You know, this is not something I've ever thought about before, but it seems to me actually that some of the longest running shows in Christendom have gone the other way from being confessional in their sectarian origins and insisting on purity of doctrine and shared belief, and over time have become tribal, if you will. It's more a matter of community than of shared belief, and less insistent on, you know. I was actually struck a few years ago when I was in Salt Lake City talking to some Mormons to discover that there are Mormons who take a sort of amused and condescending view of some of the key doctrines of that church. I mean, you expect this sort of thing from a worldly Monsignor in the Catholic Church, you know, talking about folk religion, but I didn't know there were Mormons like that. I don't think there are many of them, you know, and I think their position not terribly secure, but the idea that as the Mormon church becomes mature or decadent, take your pick, such people emerge is an interesting one to me. I don't know where that comment leads, but the question of tribalism being the early stages is not clear to me that's necessarily true.
David?
Go back to something Barry was talking about and something Greg picked up on and John followed up on, the idea about the feelings about the colleges and schools on the state level, and particularly stories. One of the other things I would add to the definition of Southerners back several minutes ago is that Southerners, you ask most Southerners a question, and somewhere along the line of the answer, you'll get a story. Tonight, not being a learned Yankee, I'm going to have three stories instead of 3 points. I think that these stories, I'll tell you one that I heard about Clarence Jordan. This is a story that when he was a young pastor and way ahead of his time preaching for the moderating racist culture in the South, and a dear lady came up to him after the story goes. Always the possibility of these stories are apocryphal, but being a cultural historian, my motto is never let the truth get in the way of a good story. So that's right, I'm in the Liberty Party on that one. That's right, take broad liberties with stories. But this dear lady came up and said, Mr. Jordan, I just want you to know that you're preaching against my dear old granddaddy. And what do you suppose Jordan's response was? Well, ma'am, your choice is very clear. You can either choose the good Lord Jesus Christ or you can follow your dear old granddaddy. Now, that kind of loyalty to one's heritage is not unique to the South, but I think it's particularly powerful because, and this is one of the reasons Russians are interested in Southern literature, this is the only part of the United States that's ever been conquered other than if you're talking about driving away the Native Americans, but But, you know, we were invaded like they were, and that has a great power. And those identities in Charles Regan Wilson's book, Baptized in Blood, has eloquently demonstrated the religion of the lost cause is dripping off of everything that people think about their add Flannery O'Connor and the her sense of the South as a Christ-haunted region, and that it's a place where people obsess about and wonder and think about the terrible speed of God's mercy, but these things are embodied in these stories, and particularly, and this I think this is the most interesting paradox about this, for a group traditionally maligned by outsiders as being less well educated, it is particularly focused on schools. Even people who never went to these schools have a fierce loyalty. And I think that's exactly what the BGCT decision about last year was. It's about Baylor. We were talking about this a little bit at lunch. I think you could find some, you know, reason to think I'm just speculating wildly, but I think that that most of the decisions about Baptist life on the state level in Texas have been about Baylor. I happen to be working at Baylor in 1990. In fact, I started to talk about my title of my talk tonight, when the guy in the suit unplugged the fax machine. Back in 1990, fax machines were not so prevalent, and 12-year-olds didn't have them. Now they do. But we were working in the Tibble Bible Building. That's where the oral history office, which also has the headquarters of the offices for the religion department. And that was the only fax machine in the building. And on a particular day, I think it was a Friday, Board of Trustees was on campus, and somebody came down to our office and said, the weirdest thing just happened. Some guy in a suit just unplugged the fax machine in the religion department office. Well, we thought that's kind of ominous sounding. You know, why does a guy in a suit care? Well, what we didn't know was that this very carefully orchestrated charter change was underway at that very moment. The Board of Trustees were meeting in the Patneff Hall. They voted the change in. Agents of this law firm that had been advising the university on that were going around campus unplugging fax machines so no fundamentalist trustee could get a restraining order to shut that down. They had somebody in the Secretary of State's office in Austin ready to hand the charter, already signed. So they said, it's done. They voted for it, handed it to them, and it was done. And then all of that stuff has taken on this mythological character that's the only time the moderates outsmarted the fundamentalists. That's the way Baptists in Texas tell that story. But I think that the power of those stories and the rootedness of the South in stories is not to be denied. And oddly enough, I think it has a lot to do with these colleges and universities.
David, that brings up an area that has been, I find, very compelling, very fascinating. I'm not sure how it relates to Southern Baptist exactly, but that is this issue of inferiority and why education is so important. Southerners have this sense that they are inferior, or at least have a sense that other parts of the country consider them to be inferior. And they seem to redouble their resolve to prove to the rest of the country that they are not inferior, that they are as smart as Boston, as financially savvy as New York, and as cool and fashionable as California. And part of it has to do with education. I wonder, you know, why does Richard Land go to Princeton? Why?
Oxford.
Yes, and I think that's part of it. And I think that at least to some extent, this sense of being a provincial and being exposed to a more cosmopolitan culture and wanting to be a part of that and prove that you can be a good cosmopolitan does at least to some extent play into some of the earlier progressive, the early moderate leadership of the 40s and 50s and 60s. As they realized that the racism with which they were brought up was provincial, not cosmopolitan, and they rebelled against that provincialism. And perhaps, and I don't know, but perhaps the conservatives, they're reaching out to some of these, Francis Schaeffer, Carl Henry, some of the other neo-evangelicals, that may be playing into it as well. I'm not, as they're reacting against what they consider to be provincialism of moderate Southern Baptist bureaucratic culture in the convention. Any thoughts on that, anyone?
You mentioned Land, and Land says that it was when he went to, I think it was him, when he went to Princeton is when he, and this would be, you would expect this, is when he began to realize how provincial his region was on the issue of race. And I couldn't help but think of Paul's allusion to Ralph Ellison and the drops of black and white, that when Land gets to Princeton, the person he identifies most with is an African-American Southerner, and he's never had a black friend prior to getting to Princeton. He said he never even knew a black person his age until he got there, but that's the one he identified with. So you have this white and black intermingling at the same time you had segregation, and it just fascinating sort of stuff, I think.
But don't we have a tension here then between, on the one hand, the drive to cosmopolitanize oneself that you're speaking of, and on the other hand, the thesis that Barry's presented about the issues that work best are those that allow one to take a stand against a culture that is perceived as down the drain at this point anyway, in which you are intentionally sort of going in the other direction and saying, I don't care if you see us as provincial on this issue, this is our stand, this is our biblical support for it. And hence something like the 1998 resolution, which reeks of provincialism to people in Colorado and California and every place else, but is very important to make for the reasons that Barry talked about. So that, I mean, there seems to be a real tension there.
Yes, I agree.
Well, I think this, we'll touch on this tonight, the snobbishness with which the moderate leadership looked down on people to their right, I think is well documented, and I that went the other way too, a little bit, to a certain extent, to people on the left, and I particularly think about Foy Valentine, who shows up a lot in my book, the self styled gatekeeper of a lot of power in the inner circles of Southern Baptist life, but also who widely was called by other people, I don't think he ever used this expression about himself, but widely called the conscience of Southern Baptists. Valentine, in very openly in interviews that I did with him and others have done with him, is very critical of the fundamentalist mentality of what he calls the Adrian Rogersites and the Presslerites and the Pattersonites, and he puts ites on lots of folks' names. But he also looks down on the people on the other end who went to Yale Divinity School, then came back to the South, and then thought themselves too good to get in the trenches and work for Southern Baptist agencies and causes. And those are the people in this progressive group I talk about. Let's say a little bit about them tonight. But the main objects of the condescension, and I think of the derision, were the people to the right. The moderates were pretty unsparing in their criticism of literalists, and long after, and they were very slow, and I think there's one reason they just were not just outworked, but they were outsmarted in the 80s. And they kept thinking what you folks call conservative resurgence, what I call fundamentalist, that's going to fall apart any day, because they just didn't think they were smart enough to pull it off. And they kept being proven wrong year after year, and they never figured it out till it was over. And I think it was over by 1985. I'll talk a little bit about that tonight, too. But that they've forgotten that fundamentalism itself was an intensely intellectual phenomenon in the 19th century, which has been alluded to here. A very intentionally rationalistic viewpoint that was not, it didn't say you have to disconnect your brain to believe these things. They said they're perfectly logical. We are consistent with every form of logic you want to deal with. And I think they always were underestimated. And I think the moderates believed what H.L. Mencken had said about fundamentalists in the 1920s. That they were hayseeds and rubes, long after they certainly weren't. And the leadership, you don't have to go to Princeton and Oxford to be smart. These were not dumb people. But finally, they started having the degrees to back that up, and by the time folks in the moderate middle realized it was over.
Well, if it's okay with the panel, I'd like to open it up for the questions from the floor now. You have a question? Yes, Darrell, can you come up to the microphone, please?
Is there anything Southern about being Baptist?
Anything what?
Is there anything Southern about being Baptist? Does Southernness reinforce Baptistness or not?
As the one up here undoubtedly knows least about it, let me just... I do see a correspondence in the worldview, this emphasis on individual responsibility, which may once upon a time have been an American theme, not a Southern one, but by the 20th century, I think it's become a Southern one. It's a suspicion of corporate bodies, suspicion of organization, and an emphasis on individual responsibility. You see it, obviously, in theology, but you see it also in for example, Southern homicide rates, which again and again reflect a tendency to settle disputes privately, sometimes violently. You know, you don't go to court. You don't bring in the police or the societal institutions to settle your disputes. You deal with it one-on-one. Sometimes that means violently. You see it in some of my historian friends tell me I'm wrong about this, but I think I'm right. You see it in the suspicion of labor unions. An employment contract is an individual arrangement between an employer and an employee, and you don't need third parties interfering in that. It's something at base, I'd say unmanly, but I think this ethic is not just a masculine one. But there's something wrong about bringing in third parties to settle your affairs for you. And I believe there is a correspondence there. Now, who's influenced whom, I don't know. But for what it's worth, I do see that as something Southern about being Baptist or vice versa.
I think that the key there is who's influenced whom on that issue. Undoubtedly, there's a strong individualist component within Baptist history, but it might not be as strong as 20th century Southern Baptist moderates think it is. There's some historical work going on, some theological work. There's actually a third group of Southern Baptists that nobody knows about who put together what's called a Baptifesto several years ago. And these are people who are trying to as a Baptist manifesto, it's called a Baptifesto, but they're trying to recapture historically the strong sense of congregational, communitarian sort of values that Baptists had up into at least the early part of the 19th century, if not throughout the 19th century. And this third group, they see the moderates and the conservatives as both being products of kind of Enlightenment modernity in various ways, either in their conservative side, in their kind of rational, confessional approach to theology, or in the moderate side, in their heightened expressions of individuality, both of which, individuality and rationalism, could be very much argued to be products of modernity. Last night, President Moeller talked about the Southern Baptist controversy being a delayed response to modernity, but I think you could also see it, Southern Baptist conservative movement, as a delayed expression of modernity in some ways. So to go back to what John was saying, that this Southern individualism that becomes strong and that Southern Baptists pick up on, it may have been symbiotic, but I'm pretty sure that not all Baptists in history are as highly individualistic as somebody like a moderate spokesperson like James Dunn would have us believe. I think there are probably, or were probably, some stronger communitarian values. I think Greg's book points this out as well. So there may have been kind of a working relationship as the South appropriated more individualism. Southern Baptists were coming to dominate the South, and they fed each other. So I'm not clear on that, but it's interesting.
Can I jump in? I don't think individualism of the kind I'm talking about is inconsistent with communitarianism. In fact, in some ways, it's the opposite side of the coin. W.J. Cash wrote also about the savage ideal of conformity, as a Southern trait, and the kind of community that I think you see often in the South, and it's very strong, is a community, though, that is freely chosen, that you're free to leave from, and some people do, thereby strengthening the community of the ones who are left. It's one that's based on similarity, not interdependence or division of labor. It's based on things in common. In that sense, it's what Emile Durkheim would call mechanical solidarity rather than organic. No, it's the other way around. Durkheim confuses me. But, anyway, it's based on similarity and not difference, not division of labor.
Well, that idea of communities being freely chosen is interesting because Rawlsian political liberalism would view congregations as voluntary societies. And sometimes when I hear spokespersons for moderate Southern Baptist life, they sound like congregations are voluntary communities. Well, they are in the eyes of the larger dominant culture, but from a theological standpoint, a congregation being a local expression of the body of Christ is not a voluntary community. It precedes any of the individuals who would have joined it in a theological sense. And this is what this third group of Baptist theologians are arguing, that much of what came to be expressed as moderate Baptist identity in the 20th century Southern Baptist Convention is in many ways more accurately viewed as an expression of kind of enlightenment, modernity, political liberalism, individualism. Individuals are autonomous and freely choose the communities to which they will belong. Now, this group also has its criticisms of the conservative side and showing where they think they are also a product of modernity. So it's just some fascinating stuff going on. A lot of work to be done.
One of the complicating issues here is whether the individualism is anti-authoritarian and anti-hierarchical. Nathan Hatch argues that American individualism is, and that included the South. But let's move on. Other questions?
I wanted to kind of follow up Dr. Reed's point about Southern culture being a face-to-face culture, an organic culture, in light of what Dr. Moeller pointed out last night about the demographic shifts in Southern Baptist Convention and how the largest churches are in suburban, urban areas. They're mega churches. They seem to lead to the breakdown of face-to-face relations, would lead to the breakdown of organic relations because it's impossible to know every other member of a 2,000-member church, or it's impossible for pastors to exercise oversight over a 2,000-member church. How does that then get at the whole question of, are Southern Baptists Southern, if Southern culture is this social bond individualism relationship thing?
Let me talk about another large Southern institution that's been successfully exported, and that's Walmart. Walmart has the greeter at the door, and usually it's some church lady that they hire to stand there and greet people. There's a sort of pseudo-Gemeinschaft that is attached to Walmart. And I'm not familiar with any of these large churches. I've seen them from the street. That's about it. But my impression is that it's not pseudo-Gemeinschaft, but they do a lot in small groups. I mean, they are aware of this problem, and they try to deal with it by incorporating smaller groups within the larger collectivity. How successfully, I don't know, but it's not like working for General Motors. I won't say it's like working for Walmart, but there is a sensitivity there to the problem, I understand.
Yes, Ben.
And it is a problem.
Professor Terry.
Well, I would say the Southern Baptist Convention is becoming less Southern. If you read Southern Baptist state papers in the 1950s, in almost every issue, you'll see some reference to our Southwide efforts, our Southwide convention, our Southwide campaign. You don't see that kind of terminology anymore because there are Southern Baptist churches in all 50 states. And so you just don't see that Southwide terminology as you used to do. I think Dr. Harvey was asking about the growing ethnicity of the Southern Baptist Convention. Over the past several years, our North American Mission Board has averaged planting about 1,500 new churches each year. Half of those are ethnic and black churches. And this has been true for about 10 years. So we're becoming increasingly ethnic, as is the general population, and we're becoming increasingly African American.
Are those ethnic churches both in the South and in other parts of the
Well, they would tend to be more numerous in the South simply because there are more mother churches to start them.
Right.
And more resources to get them going. But really, they're all over the United States.
I just want to add one thing that I refer to this. I can't remember when this was. I think it's the early 60s. W.A. Criswell called for changing the name, and his suggestion was Continental Baptist Convention. And I think that he was anticipating the change from Home Mission Board to North American, and that kind of, you know, he's way ahead of his time, and that is in so many other of these things we now are talking about.
But which continent? I have worshipped with the Southern Baptist congregation in Germany at one time. I wouldn't disagree with that, certainly. I used the analogy of NASCAR, as something that's still sort of cultural. But last night, because I'm still on Pacific time, I found myself watching Nightline, and Ted Koppel was raising the question of, is NASCAR still Southern? And the consensus was, for now.
Other questions? Bill Sumners.
In the early 1920s, the Southern Baptist Convention undertook a study of rural churches. E.P. Aldridge headed that up. And out of about 22,000 Southern Baptist churches, 19 were viewed as rural churches. And I think Dr. Moeller alluded to that thing that Sean also mentioned, that even though Southern Baptists there are still a lot of rural churches out there, the predominance of membership is in suburban town mega churches right now. So the question is, how has the loss of its rural nature affected Southern Baptists and their Southernness?
While you guys are thinking about that, let me tell you something. Let me tell you something that actually you may not know, and that makes the South unique in the world. The South is the one place I'm familiar with where urban working class people go to church as often as rural people do. Mm-hmm. And everywhere else in the world, when you've had urban to rural movement, the first thing that suffers is church attendance. It certainly happened in England in the 19th century. It's happened in France and Brazil and every place I know that the urban working class and poor are perhaps the least churched segment of the population. Didn't happen in the South. And one reason is that the dominant religion of the South is the Baptist Church and groups like it, which are congregational in their polity and can change with this kind of demographic change with relative ease. It doesn't take a central committee somewhere in the church headquarters to plan for change. A bunch of Baptists move to the city, they start a church. As I understand it, it's almost that simple. And it happened on the southern frontier as well, which is why the South is Baptist today. The Church of England was still trying to figure out how to get ministers ordained when they had to go to London to do it. So the Baptists made haze while the sun shone and evangelized the frontier. We Episcopalians were sitting on our hands. This kind of polity that you all have is tremendously flexible and adaptable to changing circumstances, and seems to have adapted to this one more successfully than most church polities.
Paul, did you want to say something about that?
By the way, full details of that study can be found in chapter 7, of my book, just in case anyone's curious about. I read all of that stuff. They were very worried about that problem in the early 20th century as they began to perceive, got all these mill workers, what are we going to do? These mill workers are they're Southern, but on the other hand, they're kind of ornery and it's kind of hard to get them to go to church and all that kind of, this has been a prevalent discussion for a long time. I agree with John on this point totally. There is a kind of flexibility that allows for, it sort of changes over time without anyone sort of realizing what's going on and kind of adapts. And so a lot of this worry turns out not to be all that relevant. The other worry, of course, is the flip side, which is that we still got all these rural churches. Aren't the majority of churches, not majority, but whatever percentage now is still rural, quite a large percentage, I guess. There's been a 20th century long discussion of the decline of the rural church. What are we gonna do about that? That seems to be still going on as well. I don't think anyone's ever figured that out. that's kind of a almost unsolvable kind of problem.
Yes, and since we don't have a council of bishops to decide it for us, we just do whatever comes. We have time for one more question.
Hi, my name's Darren Avery. I'm from Missouri, and I'm a first-time transplant here to Kentucky. I'm quite proud to be from all my life border states.
Next stop, Maryland.
Yeah, you bet. My question is kind of long, and I'll try to keep it brief. As I've been here and I've entered kind of into conversation with dorm mates and several other people who are from the traditional South, and the discussion of the Confederate flag as passing from the public official eye, in your opinions, any of you, what effect will that have on the subconscious sort of Southern Baptists as these icons begin to fall away? And will that either further embitter them or will it begin to kind of ease those feelings and move towards possibly the removal of Southern Baptist as a name?
Seems to me that's nothing but good for Southern Baptists, because that's a kind of that's a kind of provincial relic that a lot of people get embarrassed by. I got a call from some guy at the Atlanta Constitution who's writing an article about civil religion after the flag has been changed in Georgia and whatever they did to it in South Carolina and so forth. And he had made reference to the resolution some years back apologizing for slavery in the some SBC resolution. I don't know what year that was exactly. 95. He wanted to argue in this article that there would be this sort of crisis, sort of trauma, because of the changeover of civil religious symbols. And I said, no. They are very well aware that you have to. This is kind of stuff that doesn't appeal anymore. The intactness of the South isn't intact in that way. You've got to get rid. It's good to get rid of that kind of stuff. Make the statement about slavery that you need to make to recognize that this is a part of your history, and the official Southern Baptist history is now recognized that was central to the formation of the Southern Baptist Convention. It wasn't these technical debates about societies versus denominations and so forth. It really was about slavery. And you just, you admit that, you get over it, and you move on. So it seems to me that's nothing but good.
I mentioned earlier that the nature of Southern identity has changed, and changed in the 60s and 70s in particular, but it's still changing. In 1900, if you asked people what it meant to be Southern, you got an answer that had to do with the Confederacy, and it had to do with saluting the flag and standing up for Dixie and celebrating Robert E. Lee's birthday and standing in a particular relation to the lost cause. And that's one reason black folks weren't included. If you ask people these days, and we've done it on survey research, what it means to be Southern, you get very ahistorical answers. People don't mention the Civil War. They don't. They talk about manners and accents and food and family values and all kinds of things, but they don't talk about the history of the group. Now, that can be good or bad. I'm not committing myself on that question, but that it is a change of some significance is really, I think, quite important. Now, the people who care about the Confederate flag care passionately, and I know a good many of them, and they're not going to give it up without a fight and a fuss, and we're going to be hearing about it for a long time. But there are not that many of them. Again, we've got survey research to back us up. Sons of Confederate Veterans had 25,000 members. The United Confederate Veterans had 250,000 at one time. It's just, we've asked people if they have Confederate ancestors. A third of white Southerners know that they have Confederate ancestors. A third don't know whether they do or not, and a third don't think they do. Okay. 40% of white Southerners think they have American Indian ancestors. the Confederacy just doesn't play the same role in Southern identity that it used to, for better or for worse. I think for better for the most part.
Anyone want a last word here? Is that it? Well, our next session is at 7:30, and let's give a round of thanks to our panelists.